You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, Leah.
Hey, Sean.
You know what now's a good time for?
What's that?
A promo for the Soul Forge podcast.
The Soul Forge? What's that?
Oh, it's a show. It's a podcast all about sex and dating.
Love and relationships.
Pop culture and movie reviews.
Adventure.
Almost anything you can think of.
Definitely.
What is it?
The Soul Forge.
The Soul Forge podcast.
Think about it.
This is full-scale war against a terrible enemy that modern man has never fought before.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we've got a real monster movie, sci-fi thriller. It falls into many, many categories. And it's called It's Alive. From 1974, it is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Now, some of you out there may be saying, hey, Jim, I thought that you and Mark several seasons ago did a show on a movie called It's Alive. Well, we did. And this one's always confused with that one. And it shouldn't be, because this one is a good movie. And the other one was an early rag-a-rama from us on Monster Attack. Now, that one you're thinking about was from 1969. It was directed by Larry Buchanan. But this one, the one we're talking about this week, came out in 1974, 5 years later. And it was written, produced, and directed by a guy I think was one of the most ingenious and brilliant independent directors of the 70s and 80s. Now, you hear me mention a lot on the show about how I just felt so lucky to have grown up during what I consider to be the golden years of independent cinema, mainly centered around the 1970s, slips a little bit into the late 1960s, and then some into the early 1980s. But there was just this a group of young independent filmmakers that turned the whole system on its ear. And we had films that were just magnificent successes, like Easy Rider, Vanishing Point, movies like this one, It's Alive, and others that just made millions and millions of dollars. Billy Jack is another classic example. The year it came out, it was the top grossing film of the year for a small indie budget film. And eventually the big studios got wind of this. They couldn't help but get wind of this, because these films were challenging their big blockbusters. And a lot of executives said, hey, we need to get in on this. And so slowly, a lot of these independent producer-directors, like Larry Cohen, were approached by big studios and offered a chance to have their films financed with full creative control. And that went on for quite a while before it got a little bit out of control, and then there were some major, major busts that forced the big studios to reorganize once again. We've seen a little bit of that again nowadays with the digital age, because it is so much more inexpensive to make a film with the digital technology, which is just incredible. You know, 4K, 8K, 16K. This stuff looks better than the films, you know, that we saw in 35 and 70 millimeter, way back when we were growing up. So we've got another round of indie gems, I think, that will be coming out within these next few years as well. But It Lives will go down as one of the most popular and endearing cult films of all times. Now, parents, this is one that's probably not going to be good for a small child. I think it's a little too intense. It really doesn't have a lot of blood in it. And most of the horror of what we're going to see here, and we'll get into that a little bit more in the storyline, is left to your imagination, or is just slightly off screen. So, and as we've said on so many occasions, films that leave a lot to your imagination are the ones that generally are the most disturbing and the most scary. Well, Larry Cohen knew a lot about disturbing films, and I say that in a good way. He had a unique way of telling stories. His films always had some messages woven into the main storyline. This film will deal with the ecology, which in the early to mid 1970s was a big subject of discussion. We're really starting to get into what are we doing to this planet? You know, are we destroying our world? We need to make some changes. And of course, we haven't done much in the last 50 years, and now we're facing all those same questions again. But Larry deals with that here. And he also deals with, and this is something that I'd sort of forgotten about until I went back and rewatched this film a while back, about the problems with Big Pharma. Yeah. You know, that's not just a problem that we're experiencing here within the last 20 years. And that has been a source of concern, you know, recently with all these drugs that are hitting the market, and are they being properly checked out by the FDA? And, you know, some that have been pulled off the market, which, you know, a few years after they've been, you know, received all of this publicity and stuff, and all these people are on them, find out, whoops, they're not very good. They're doing bad things to you. And this is coming on the heels of something that happened in the 1950s. And it involved a pregnancy drug that had some serious consequences for the mothers and the children that were taking the children weren't taking the drug, but the mothers were. It was supposed to help ease the pain of labor and that sort of thing, and it created some serious birth defects in the late 1950s and early 1960s. So Cohen nibbles, quite a bit at that as well. That's also a big part of the story, is how Big Pharma has a lot to do with this film. Now, I will tell you, before we get started, that if for some reason you've not seen It's Alive, and there's a good chance that you may not have, I'm going to spoil everything. There are twists and turns in this, but the film's been out, for 50 years. It spawned two sequels. So I think most people sort of know the basic plot of this movie, but the movie is so much deeper than just a basic story about a mutant baby. I'll go that way and give you a chance to put us on pause and go check out the film. It's very easy to find. Now, on some of the streaming services, there might be a charge for it, but you can find a very nicely restored copy of it on YouTube, and it won't cost you anything. And in fact, the YouTube copy, I didn't even have to watch commercials. It was the full 1974 restored version, and it was beautiful. I was really surprised because a lot of times the YouTube movies will come with commercials. So mine did not. So that's a good alternative right there. This is one I had in my collection when it came out on home media, and of course that's one, my whole collection got destroyed back in 2011. So I'm just glad that it is very easy to find on streaming, and it's well worth a look. And I want to talk first about Larry Cohen, the director, before we get into the heart of It's Alive. This guy is like so many independent directors that were popular during this time period. He's a kid like, and I'm not comparing him to Ed Wood, but they had similar childhoods where he grew up and he was just absolutely addicted to film, like all of us were. Born in 1936, we lost him just recently in 2019, did a ton of film and television work. You have probably seen his work and not even realized it if you're not a Larry Cohen fan. He'll always be known for It's Alive. This will be one of his signature works. But 2 years after It's Alive came out, he did a film that I discovered accidentally I didn't even realize it was one of his. And it was during the VHS years. Just happened to see it. It looked sort of intriguing. It was in a video store. So I rented it for a weekend. Film that came out in 1976. God Told Me To. And you will see that you will find that streaming as well. That is another one that's pretty easy to find. I believe the easiest way to find it may be on Tubi. Now, that one you're going to have to watch commercials with. But I remember watching that film, and then when I saw who it was that directed it, and then the movie blew me away. It's a serial killer film. I don't know if it's one we'll talk about here. Maybe a little too bloody for what we do here at Monster Attack. But I have such respect for the work of Larry Cohen that we may bring it in here with some warnings. But just a brilliant film. And then he comes back with two sequels. It Lives Again, and then It's Alive, Island of Terror, I believe is what it was called, which came out several years later. It Lives Again came out in 1978. He did the sequel to Salem's Lot. You remember the Salem's Lot? It was a two-part miniseries. And in 1987, the network hired Larry Cohen, I believe it was ABC, to do a Return to Salem's Lot, which is not a bad film. Not too bad for a made-for-TV film. Again, it was a two-part miniseries type thing. And, a capable sequel to what I thought was one of the better made-for-TV films made, Salem's Lot, and a good interpretation of Stephen King's work. And then he just went on to, he kept working into the 2000s with some great stuff. He wrote the screenplay for Phone Booth, which came out in 2002, Cellular in 2004, and Captivity in 2007. All three of them, I guess you would call them maybe crime thrillers, and involved, some very, very intense situations. A television show that he did that I did not realize was a Larry Cohen film was Branded. One that we, as kids growing up in the 60s, loved, starring Chuck Connors. That's where he got his start with the networks. And then he went on to produce and pitch a TV show that ran for two seasons, which we, all those of us who were monster kids, loved, called The Invaders. And that's where I first learned of Larry Cohen and would look for his stuff here and there. Now, I'm trying to get them all mixed up here. The Invaders, ABC did something very, very weird. And that was, Cohen pitched it to him. They loved the concept and all that stuff. Then they said, okay, thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. You're all done. And they continued on and put on the show themselves. They did a similar thing to The Outer Limits and some other shows like that. Outer Limits that didn't totally take over, but Joe Stefano didn't have a whole lot of control over that show after a while. And and the same thing sort of happened with The Invaders. Larry Cohen later on in an interview said that he wished he could have held on to that. The network would have let him keep the show as he had visualized it. He would have taken the lead character of David Vincent and giving him a little bit more of a sense of humor, a little more humanity, and not so quite as uptight as he is in the show. I still love, don't get me wrong, I love the show. And then he also would have put in less aliens. We would have seen them less, and they would have been harder to kill. And I think if they had allowed Larry to do that and hold on to the show, I think the show would have run a lot longer than two seasons. Because the show in the second season does feel sort of rushed. Like ABC is like, okay, come on, let's wrap it up. But anyway, we're talking now 1974. Oh, by the way, the second sequel that came out in 1987 to this film, It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive. I found my note right after I blanked on what the name of the title was. So the It's Alive movies, had a pretty good run here for about 14 years. And there was a remake in 2009. I didn't really care for it. That's all I'm going to say. Just, I didn't really care for it. As with so many of these independent gems that came out during this time period, that the studios would go back and try to remake years and years later, the new directors and producers, all I can say is they didn't get it. They didn't get it. So let's find out what it is they didn't get. We'll talk about our cast. Really, really good cast in this. Now, these are not huge name stars when they're cast in this film, but they would go on to have very long careers. And our lead, I'll say our two leads, centers around a couple. The wife is pregnant, and the expectant father is played by John P. Ryan. And John P. Ryan is one of those character actors of my generation that you'll recognize. Another in the Dick Miller school of character acting, where you go, man, I know, I've seen him in so many things. And he did so much film work and television work. I will always remember John P. Ryan for his role in one of my all-time favorite films from the early 1980s, and that is The Right Stuff. John played the NASA public relations guy. He's the one that gets into the fight with John Glenn about letting the vice president interview his wife and all that stuff. John would show up in a bunch of different roles and a lot of times would play, I won't say a bad guy, but maybe a guy that you didn't really warm up to a whole lot. But in this one, he plays probably one of the most interesting roles I've ever seen him play. Because he is going to be the father of this child that's born. And initially, he's absolutely appalled by it, but changes his mind as the movie wears on. And this is the one thing about Larry Cohen films that I really, really like. Larry doesn't give you shallow characters. And his stories aren't shallow. Now, you might think so, but when you hear my description of the timeline, well, let me tell you that this movie is so layered. This is what made this film a hit. Now, it's interesting, the executives from Warner Brothers that had approached Larry Cohen and said, hey, we want you to do a movie for us. And he had pitched them the It's Alive script. And they liked the concept and said, here's $500,000. Go make the movie. And they didn't mess with him. Just go make the movie. Let us know when you're done. And when Larry was finished with the film, he brought it back to Warner Brothers. And unfortunately, as happens in this business a whole lot, the executives who had backed the project were no longer there and had been replaced by other executives who thought, well, we're not that crazy about this. So they had a one theater release, and then they did a very limited release in 1974. I don't even remember it because in 74, I was still in college. My folks had relocated to Atlanta, and I don't remember any publicity or advertising. I don't think it came anywhere near where I was. And then 3 years later, there was a changeover again. And so Larry went back to the executives, the new executives, and showed them the film, and they liked it. And they planned a whole new ad campaign for it, which was simply the graphic that we used for the show here was the film poster from the 77 release. Just shows a little baby carriage on a black background with the ominous text above it saying, there's something wrong with the Martin baby. It's alive. And I remember that campaign. And it was like, I have got to see this movie. Got to see this movie. And so did a lot of other people. And on their $500,000 investment, this release in 1977 returned more than $7 million. And once home video kicked in and all of that, this film made a ton of money. It was very, very successful. And I think it helped launch John Ryan's career, because that's when he really started doing everything. And he was just showing up at all kinds of TV shows and jumping roles in films and things of that nature. And again, I think he has one of the more interesting roles in this movie. Some people have compared it to Dr. Frankenstein, in a sense, taking the blame and fearful that maybe he created this monster, because it is about a mutant baby and wanting to do nothing but kill it. Sort of like what Dr. Frankenstein did in the book Frankenstein. Now let's talk about his wife, Lenore, played by the lovely Sharon Farrell. And Sharon Farrell was one of these people that got our attention growing up. She would show, just pop in and out of movies here and there. She originally started out as a ballerina with American Ballet Theater Company. Got into movies in 1959 with the film Kiss Her Goodbye, 40 Pounds of Trouble, Lovely Way to Die. And then the first film I remember seeing her in, because I was huge into film noir, there was a film that came out in 1979 called Marlowe. Remember that one? Based on the Chandler novel. But Sharon really worked more in television than she did in movies. In television shows like Saints and Sinners, Dr. Kildare, Hawaii 5-0, the original ones. These are all the ones from the 60s. And just worked nonstop. And when I would, every time I would turn around, she would show up in something like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., My Favorite Martian, Beverly Hillbillies, all the stuff I watched. And then spent a long time on the cast of The Young and the Restless. And I wasn't into soap operas, so I didn't see her there. But she had quite a fan following. And we lost her just this past year, in May of 2023. And she's got a tough role to play in this one, too, just like with John P. Ryan, because she gives birth to this mutant baby. Oh, by the way, I should say that we lost John in 2007. Died from a stroke back then, following a very prolific career. But I'm going to be jumping in and out of the cast as well as the storyline, because the film really centers around, in the very beginning, Frank and Lenora. She wakes up, says, "Frank, it's time. Time to go to the hospital." Of course, Frank has got this all planned out, methodically gets all the bags together, makes the phone call. Now, they have an 11-year-old son, or I'm guessing around 11. He's a sixth grader. Chris, played by Daniel Holtzman, one that I don't know that much about. He didn't do a whole lot, but he does an admirable job in this. One of the better child actors of that age that I've seen. Makes arrangements for Chris to stay with his friend Charlie, played by William Wellman Jr. Again, another fellow you're going to recognize from tons of film and television work. He was in all kinds of things. He always played, in his early career, he always played characters like Charlie, the best friend of the lead or whatever, the good neighbor. Take Chris, while they go to the hospital. Even though Chris says, "Hey, I should be at the hospital with you guys." And the father says, no, it's best that, even his mother, Lenora, says, "No, they don't like little boys hanging around this. You're better staying with Charlie, and we'll be fine. A couple of days I'll be home, and, then everything will be back to normal again." They wish. So they drop off Chris. They go to the hospital. Got a wonderful scene with Frank and all the other expectant fathers, a couple of new ones. Of course, he's already been through this once before, 11 years earlier. And as we find out, and this is something that's very subtly brought into the storyline, and one of the things that I love about Larry Cohen, he gets these little messages in. You don't even realize it. Here it is. 11 years later, Frank is there with the expectant fathers, almost like doing it all over again, like it for the first time again. I mean, that's a pretty long stretch between kids. And we find out that Lenora had been taking a contraceptive drug, quote-unquote, the pill. Not the pill, but just a contraceptive drug like that. We find that out through conversations that Frank has with her doctor. This is one of those times it didn't work. She still got pregnant. But, Frank was a big ad executive for the PR firm. And when they had Chris, it was quite a changeover for them to become parents and all that stuff. And he was very career oriented. And Lenora decided to be a stay-at-home mom. And they had planned that they weren't going to have any more children, that Chris would be the only one. So when she did get pregnant again, it really caught them by surprise. So this is a little sub-story that weaves itself all throughout this. And knowing this, if you don't catch it the first time you watch this film, go back and watch it again, because it totally changes how this film plays. Some of the other people you're going to see in this are Guy Stockwell. He's Dean Stockwell's brother. So he's not the Stockwell that played in Quantum Leap, but Guy Stockwell, had about 30 films under his credit, a lot of TV work. James Dixon, who plays Lieutenant Perkins, he's going to be investigating the weird going on that we're going to get ready to talk about. I know I'm stretching it out. Michael Ancera, who was married to Barbara Eden for 16 years, from 1958 to 1974, he would show up in all kinds of films. Sometimes, he played bad guys really well. I remember Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, he was a pretty good bad guy. But you know, for three decades, he would show up in all kinds of things. I mean, he was a character actor who also could play a lot of ethnicities. So he played a lot of Indians during all those Westerns of the 50s and the 60s because he just had a very, very unique look. He shaved his head like Yul Brynner. So some people think, oh, wow, is that Yul Brynner? I was like, no, it's not. And we lost him about 10 years ago, 2013. He was 91 years old when he passed away. Long, long life and very active right up to the end. I liked him. He was one of my more favorite character actors. Someone else you're going to see in this film, another old-time character actor you'll recognize from television and also a lot of films, Robert Emhart. Robert Emhart always played a sleazeball. That's all I can say. He was sort of an overweight, older guy, had a high-pitched voice. He would play either a crooked businessman or a crooked politician, that sort of thing, and he was very good at it. And in this, he plays our executive of a big pharmaceutical company, which is going to be a major, major point of contention in this storyline. All right, those are your main people that you're going to see in this movie. Now let's get into what makes this movie so cool. So you've got Frank and Lenora. They're at the hospital. They had tried to avoid having a child by using these contraceptive pills, but unfortunately didn't work. And this part of the movie is so weird in a good way. You've heard me talk about movies that were unsettling, didn't feel like something was right. And you've got Frank with all of these other expectant fathers, most of them are there for the first time, not knowing what's going to happen, how long it's going to take, how long is she going to be in labor. But something just doesn't feel right. Frank's getting a little, you know, he's getting a little restless. He's not too worried. He's a veteran at this. He's already had one child that he's gone through. Walks back out into the hallway near the nurse's station, and he's going to get some coffee from the coffee machine. And it's awfully quiet. Of course, it's the middle of the night, but the way that Larry Cohen shoots this, just something is a little off. And then you see it. There's a body lying in the hallway up near where the operating room, where the delivery room was. And at first you think, am I dreaming? Am I hallucinating? As far as Frank goes, you know. Frank slowly makes his way up and realizes a guy dressed in scrubs has got blood on him, which would not be unusual because if he was in there delivering a baby, there's going to be some blood. And we have seen some scenes from within the delivery room during all this, flashing back and forth to him waiting for the expectant fathers. It's a hard pregnancy. She's having a difficult time delivering. And she keeps saying, there's something wrong, there's something wrong, there's something wrong. So you got that in the back of your mind watching this as well. And then Frank just sort of makes his way to the delivery room. The door is wide open. And he, to his horror, and you only see this in quick flashes. And like, this is what I said, there is some blood, but it's not overt. Not overt like what we're going to start seeing in about 5 years from now with the slasher films. Everyone in the delivery room is dead. Killed. They're all lying on the floor, but Lenora's there. They had her strapped down. She's going nuts. I want to see my baby. They took my baby. Somebody took my baby. The baby's not there. And Frank's trying to settle her down, and then he runs back out to get some help, and we have a little time shift. And the police are there. This is where we meet Lieutenant Perkins, Bob Clayton, some of the other cops that you're going to see in this, trying to figure out what the hell happened. And they find out that it was a baby boy, terribly deformed and born with fangs and claws. And after It comes out. It kills all of the doctors and nurses in the delivery room and escapes through a skylight. So Frank's like, look, this is an infant. No clothes. Or how's it going to survive? It's not even going to survive the night. We got to find this child. Well, Frank and Lenore, you know, once everything gets settled down at the hospital, are allowed to go home. Of course, Lieutenant Perkins says, look, don't worry about this. We're going to keep this quiet. Okay? Don't say anything about this to anybody. But, you know, a situation like that never happened. It slips out. Next thing, Frank sees it on the news, and they mention his name. So the next day when he goes into work, he's fired from his job. And it's not just that you're fired, get out of here. It's just, it's done so sleazily. You know, his boss, you know, they're PR people. They can't tell, you know, they're not going to be straightforward. And Frank, take a vacation. You got 3 weeks coming. You know, don't worry. It's all under control. And then as soon as he's out the door, it's like, get rid of him, clear his stuff out. Well, what about the baby? Well, the baby is still alive. And then we have sort of a collage of scenes. This baby goes on a spree. First, it's a young woman who is getting ready to go to work, we assume. It's early in the morning. She hears this weird cry. And I'll tell you what, kudos to the sound effects people, because the noise they come up with for the baby is just so alien-like. I mean, it's a baby cry, but it's not a baby cry. I mean, it's really, really alien sounding. And we see the killing from the point of view of the baby very quickly. Again, you don't see a whole lot of blood. You just see a dead body at the end. The one that's the more interesting one involves a milkman. Of course, it's interesting because it sort of dates the film. I don't think they deliver milk door to door anymore. But for those of us who grew up when I did, you know, that was a common thing where, you know, the guy would deliver the milk every morning. And the milkman hears a noise and glances into the, you know, it's a little refrigerated truck with all the glasses. And what you see, well, first you hear the bottles breaking and you see this milk spilling out the back of this little truck and the white turns to red. Very effective. Well, the press is going nuts with this. And they're pushing the police. Hey, you got to find out what's going on here. You know, people are terrified. And while this is all going on, a team of medical researchers from the nearby university stopped by Frank's house and said they need to talk to him. They said, we want permission to experiment on the child's body once it's been found and killed. Because everyone says, we've got to kill this child. It's killed too many people. And Frank, this is where we realize that Frank is in total denial about this. As far as, this is not my child. I am not the father of this monster. You know, however it happened, it didn't happen because of me. And he not only signs the papers of they can have the body and all that. He joins the hunt with the police. He says, look, I want to be a part of this. I want to clear my name. Because all these news people are making it sound like something I did. Then we cut to the more sinister part of this motion picture when Lenore's doctor is contacted by the executive of the pharmaceutical company, the one played by Robert Emhart. And he says, you know, yeah, maybe this contraceptive drug we make, that could have caused the mutation, maybe. But you know what? What we need to do is just get this child destroyed so that nobody will discover that our company might be liable for this. Nobody wants that. Just going to be a lot of trouble. So here we go, the big cover-up. So now this pharmaceutical guy is going to be very close to the police investigation, and he's going to make sure this child gets killed. And, of course, Frank does too. Well, cutting to the chase here a little bit, he's on the loose. We don't really get to see him. By the way, the mock-up that they used for the mutant baby was created by Rick Baker. And Larry Cohen told him, said, look, we're not really going to see the child. We're going to keep him in the shadows, in the dark. You know, just little flashes, and he did make a full scale mask for him. So you do see a quick flash of the baby's face near the end of the film. You see enough, you get an idea of what this mutant looks like. Now in the sequel, you'll see it flat out. This is where, you know, I sort of compare it to Alien and Aliens. You know, you never really saw the monster in Alien. You did, but you didn't. A lot of it was left to your imagination. In the second one, you saw monsters all over the place. And that's sort of the way it is with It's Alive in the sequel. But Frank, he's following on the police radio where these guys are going. They end up at a school where the baby attacks and kills an officer in one of the classrooms before he gets away again. And Frank tells Lieutenant Perkins, he says, I know about this school because this is the school that my son goes to, my son Chris. So they know the baby's nearby. Maybe it's heading back to its home. It may have this instinctive feel of where its parents live. And then we find out. This is the big spoiler. So if you haven't seen the film, I'm going to spoil something for you. Lenore has been hiding the baby because the baby did show up at the house. And she's been hiding it in the basement. And while this is all going on, Chris is going nuts. Charlie has tried to keep him from the news accounts, but there's no way you can do that. It's all over the news, and Chris finds out what's going on, and he sneaks out of Charlie's house and heads to his house. He needs to be there. Well, Frank gets to the house, and he realizes Lenore's up to something, and he realizes what's going on. He confronts her, and Lenore, says, "No, he's not going to hurt us. He won't hurt anybody in our family." And Frank's like, "It's a monster. It's killing people." Frank gets his gun, gets a revolver, goes down to the basement where Chris has been there for a while. And Lenore and Frank didn't even realize he was there. And Chris is actually talking to the baby. The baby's not trying to hurt Chris. Chris says, "Well, I'll try to protect you. Don't be scared, please." But too late, Frank bursts into the basement and starts shooting at the baby. And he does clip it. The baby leaves and, Charlie, who is trying to find Chris and figures he's gone back home, gets to the house just as the baby is escaping from the basement. And unfortunately, Charlie's in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the baby kills him. But the baby is seriously injured. There's a blood trail, and it leads police to the sewers. This is where the movie sort of reminds me a little bit of Them, because, L.A. has these, those big storm sewers, and that's where the baby is gone. And Frank goes and gets a rifle, and he tells the lieutenant, I'm gonna find this baby and I'm gonna kill it. And that's where the story of Frank takes a very interesting turn. Because Frank is on his own, sort of a lone wolf here, while the police are in one area and he's in another, and Frank finds the baby. And he can't kill it. And he realizes the baby is just frightened, it's just scared. And the subtle changeover that Frank makes, and John P. Ryan does this so well. This is why I said he had a really difficult role that I think he did an outstanding job with. Where he starts apologizing to the baby. "I'm sorry. I didn't understand." He picks it up and wraps it in his coat. Of course, the coat's getting all bloody because the baby's bleeding badly. And the police sort of figure out where Frank is, and they head in his direction. So we got a nice little chase scene between Frank and the police. And just as Frank exits the sewers, unfortunately, the police have corralled him. And he's surrounded. And he says, "Look, no, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Study him. But don't hurt him. I was wrong to hurt him." And, of course, the doctor, the one who prescribed the medication to Lenore, he's yelling at the police, "You've got to kill him, he's a monster." And then Robert Emhart shows up. That's our pharmaceutical guy. Screaming at him too, saying, "Kill him, kill him." And all of a sudden, the child jumps from Frank's arms. "Well, this thing can jump." And attacks the doctor and kills him. And the cops open fire and they kill both the baby and the doctor. Now remember, folks, this film was made in 1974. And you've heard me kid around a lot, and it almost seemed like it was illegal to have a happy ending in a 1970s film. No happy ending here. Lenore's there, Frank's there. Lieutenant Perkins tells one of his officers to said, take him home. Then he decides, "No, I'll do it myself." Gets him into the car, and as they're getting ready to head to the Martin home, the radio blasts out, "Another deformed baby has been born in Seattle. Here we go again." How many of these women had taken that contraceptive drug, which is clearly now the culprit behind this? And the film ends. setting the table for the sequel, It Lives Again. This is such a cool motion picture, folks. Like I said, Larry Cohen in all of his films. I loved, you know, the one film I mentioned a while back, God Told Me To. And also one that may be my all-time favorite Larry Cohen film, Q, The Winged Serpent, the one starring David Carradine and Michael Moriarty, 1982, a very underrated film. Cohen creates in his movies such amazing characters, and his storylines are so unique and layered. They're very rich. But yes, I think if you've not seen 1974's It's Alive, this is a movie you need to see. Now, not a little kid. If you're introducing a very small child to monster movies by way of Monster Attack, this is one you want to wait on for them a little bit. Go see it first, and then you'll see what I'm talking about. You know, some little kids can handle that kind of intensity. You know, when I was, you know, in that age group, around 9 to 12 or whatever, it just depended on the film. I saw some films that were very, very intense, and then I saw a couple that, they really disturbed me, gave me some nightmares. This one, I think, would give a small child some nightmares, but it's definitely a film that needs to be seen. Quite a legacy for Larry Cohen and his unique career. I'm surprised that some filmmaker hasn't made a story of his life. And maybe somebody's talking about it because, you know, he died just a few years ago. It would be as interesting a story as like the Ed Wood film was. Not to compare his films to Ed Wood films because they're night and day. But it would be, I think, an interesting movie because his films, which were all low budget, you know, I mean, even this one for $500,000 was considered a low budget film. So imaginative, so creative. I love this guy's work. Going all the way back to The Invaders. And actually going back to Branded, because I didn't realize he had anything to do with Branded. And after The Rifleman wrapped and a few years had gone by, and then Chuck Connors comes back on the scene. Yeah. Sunday night show that we all watched and we all knew the song to. Larry Cohen's It's Alive from 1974. Check it out, folks. Hey, folks, we'll be back again with you in another week with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. I am just having so much fun here as we've gotten into this eighth season. It's just been such a different season for us from any other season we've done. Really, really enjoying myself with this one. And looking back at how this show has grown over the years. I can't thank you for your support enough, and we'll just keep on going. As long as there's monster movies and monster kids, there'll always be Monster Attack. Have a great week, folks, and we'll see you next Monday.
What if you could bring three experienced producers into your home each week to discuss your favorite movies and the people that made them? That's Tales from Hollywoodland. Your hosts, Arthur, Julian, and Steve, collectively have years of showbiz producing experience. Their weekly show is a fast-paced, fun, and very conversational experience, like spending a good time with your best movie-loving friends and family. Tales from Hollywoodland is available wherever fine podcasts are found. See you at the movies.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.